Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Kate, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop. Today's program is a collaborative effort between the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, as well as a number of other cancer-related organizations. We are delighted with your response to our program today. We have over 577 participants on the call today. You come from all of the United States, and we also have international participants from Australia, Canada, the Netherlands, Sri Lanka, and the United Kingdom. So it's a bit of a global call, and we really appreciate your spending the next hour with us. Today's program is supported through unrestricted educational grants to the Lymphoma Research Foundation from Genentech, Bio-Oncology, Biogen, IDEC, and Gilead Sciences. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program today. I want to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials that you received from Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, and those materials is information about our speakers, the topics we'll be addressing, and there also is information about all of the different organizations as resources for you. There also is an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of today's program and complete that evaluation form. You are our best consultants in terms of the programs you'd like us to offer going forward, and indeed we're planning many programs for 2014, so please do tell us what you'd like us to offer, and we'll try very hard to offer those programs. Indeed, today's program is one that many of you have asked us to offer, and it's our pleasure to offer this program, an update on chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, small lymphocytic lymphoma, SLL, and so that we have this program today because of many of your recommendations. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Bruce Chesson. And Dr. Chesson is Professor of Medicine, Head of Hematology, Deputy Chief, Division of Hematology, Oncology, Fellowship Program Director, Georgetown University Hospital, Lombardi Comprehensive Cancer Center. And Dr. Chesson is going to provide an overview of CLL-SLL, standard therapies, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Chesson.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here and to talk to you about what is the most common form of leukemia in Western countries, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, with about 15 to 16,000 new cases diagnosed each year, and which means there are hundreds of thousands of people walking around with the disease because, fortunately, patients tend to live a long time. Chronic lymphocytic leukemia is distinguished from small lymphocytic lymphoma, or SLL, simply on the basis of the number of circulating lymphocytes in the bloodstream. If you have less than 5,000, you're considered SLL, which is a lymphoma. If you have more than 5,000, which is sort of an arbitrary number, you have chronic lymphocytic leukemia. The features of the cells are basically the same. CLL is most often diagnosed incidentally. Patient goes in for a heart evaluation and comes out with leukemia because the doctor checked the blood counts and said, oh my, the white blood cell count is elevated. When the white blood cell count is elevated, the patient is usually referred to a hematologist or oncologist who does a number of studies to confirm this diagnosis. The study that's most critical is called immunophenotyping, in which certain proteins on the surface of these leukemia cells are analyzed and are determined to be present or absent. And if there's a certain pattern of proteins, such as CD20, CD19, CD5, and CD23, which are the diagnostic ones, the diagnosis is not terribly difficult. You do not need a lymph node biopsy to make the diagnosis, and you don't need a bone marrow biopsy to make the diagnosis, although that test is often important prior to initiating therapy. Once the diagnosis has been made, patients are given a stage which assesses the extent of the disease, and the system we use in this country was developed by Dr. Kanti Rai a good friend to Dr. Kipps and myself, and one of the most wonderful people on the planet. And it's based on the presence of an abnormal lymphocyte count, enlarged lymph nodes, an enlarged spleen, or a decrease in the red blood cell count or a blood platelet count. Some physicians will perform a CAT scan or CT scan to further evaluate patients, but PET scans, another imaging study, are generally not indicated in the routine evaluation of patients with CLL or SLL because the cells do not pick up the tracer that is used in that type of scan. So once a diagnosis has been made and the patient has been staged, there are a number of prognostic studies that have come into vogue in recent years. These include a test called FISH, which stands for fluorescent in situ hybridization. It's just a fancy way of looking at the chromosomes, and there are some chromosome abnormalities. These are all acquired. You're not born with them, that are favorable, and there are others that are unfavorable. There are other tests called ZAP70, CD38. There's IVGH, a gene mutational status, a newer one called NOTCH1. These are all very expensive and rarely impact on how we manage patients, except perhaps the FISH test. Just because you have adverse features doesn't mean you're not going to do well with appropriate management, and which leads into the next part of things, and that is patients don't necessarily need to be treated at the time the diagnosis is made. This seems counterintuitive. I've got a form of leukemia, and you're not going to treat me. What are you, nuts? And the issue is because the disease in some patients can be very, very indolent or slow-growing, and there are patients I follow who have not needed to be treated for more than a decade. And this is because the disease isn't progressing. So we have certain indications for treating patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia, and SLL. These include disease-related symptoms, such as fevers, drenching night sweats, profound fatigue, unexplained weight loss. They also include enlarging or very large lymph nodes or an enlarged spleen if it is continuing to grow. They include recurrent infections, abnormalities in the red blood cell count or platelet count, and those sorts of things, which would impact on the patient's well-being. Just because the white blood cell count is increased doesn't mean that the disease needs to be treated. And even if the patient has these adverse features that I mentioned previously, doesn't mean the patient needs to be treated right away. I have patients with adverse features who I've been following for years and don't require treatment. And we don't treat patients initially because, as I said, they can go for decades and not require treatment. And there have been clinical trials performed in which patients underwent a randomization to either early intervention or just the so-called watch and wait or watch and worry strategy. And the survival in patients with early stage disease was similar whether treatment was initiated early or late. And all treatment has toxicities, expense, and inconvenience. So if you don't need to be treated, then don't get treated. When treatment is indicated by the various features I mentioned previously, what is the best therapy? This is a controversial issue. There are two regimens which are used by the majority of hematologists and oncologists around the world. The first one of these is a regimen called FCR, which stands for fludarabine, cyclophosphamide or Cytoxan, and rituximab or Rituxan. The first two are chemotherapy drugs. Rituximab is a monoclonal antibody which is a protein that binds to one of these proteins I previously mentioned, the CD20 protein, on the surface of the malignant lymphocyte. This regimen gives a very high response rate, and many of these responses are durable. There is another regimen called BR, which stands for bendamustine and rituximab. Bendamustine is a drug that's been around for over 50 years. It was developed in East Germany and was approved in 2008 by the FDA because of very impressive results when it was compared with standard chemotherapy drugs. These two regimens are very active, and it is almost preference as to which one is used. They have been compared in a large clinical trial, and for older patients, BR seems to be better tolerated and comparably effective. In younger patients, it's sort of which one you prefer, or actually which one your doctor prefers. There are some issues. As I said, older patients don't tolerate the FCR as well. Patients who have kidney or liver problems are probably better off with the bendamustine regimen. And there are some other associated or disease-related phenomena which would lead one to use one regimen or the other regimen. It is very important that once you have this diagnosis made, which is a malignancy, it is a leukemia or lymphoma, that even though you're probably going to a good hematologist or oncologist, that you get a second opinion. And the reason for that will be elucidated by Dr. Kipps, and that is because there are new treatment approaches being developed all the time, and the community oncologist may not be aware of how to use them, when to use them, and other features related to these new and extremely expensive but extremely effective forms of therapy. So when you have the diagnosis made of CLL, it is very important to have a dialogue with your physician and, as I said, with a second opinion specialist in CLL, and there are a lot of these specialists around. Discuss what the disease means to you, how it is likely to impact on your life, what you may expect from it over the years, what are the indications for treatment, and do you fit those indications for treatment, and if not, why not, and what would be the best form of therapy for you. So as I've gone through here, there are standard therapies, FCR and BR, are the two for frontline treatment or initial treatment. Both are good, both are acceptable, and widely used. But you need to have a discussion with a specialist in this disease to determine which one might be preferable in your case and where newer drugs might fit in. Communication with your doctor and with his support staff is critically important. And I think I'll stop there.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Dr. Chesson. That was a superb presentation, very clear and very helpful to everyone. Thank you. And our next presenter is Dr. Thomas Kipps. Dr. Kipps is Evelyn and Edwin Tosh Chair in Cancer Research, Distinguished Professor and Deputy Director, Research Operations, UCSD, Morris Cancer Center. And Dr. Kipps is going to address new therapies, clinical trials, and supportive care. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Kipps.
Well, thank you very much, and I thank also Dr. Chesson for this very lucid description of the disease and the need to have a thoughtful approach when addressing therapy. I think that the research in CLL has brought forward new concepts and ideas of how the leukemia originates and how it is able to continue to progress, and this has resulted in new therapies that just recently have been introduced into the clinic. These have been tested in clinical trials, and just over the past year, we've had three new agents approved for the treatment of patients with CLL and SLL. In the looking at some of the new trials too that are going on, there are other promising agents that are also being investigated. So clearly there's a lot of activity here in the research and clinical trials in CLL and SLL that have brought forward new therapies that are improving patients' lives and giving more options to therapy than we've had in the past. Now, one important agent that was approved in November of 2013 is a new antibody similar to rituximab that Dr. Chesson was describing. This antibody is called obinutuzumab. It's O-B-I-N-U-T-U-Z-U-M-A-B. It's also known as Gazyva, which is the trade name. This is a genetically engineered antibody, a protein that can bind to the surface of the leukemia cell by binding to the antigen that Dr. Chesson mentioned, CD20. This antibody appears to have some enhanced activity over other antibodies such as rituximab, and this was borne out in a clinical trial that was published in the March issue of the New England Journal of Medicine this year. In this study conducted by the German CLL study group, patients were randomly assigned to receive therapy with either a drug called chlorambucil, which is similar to the drug bendamustine that has been around for some time. And this is an oral medication which is considered more along the lines of your standard chemotherapy. And patients then were randomized to receive chlorambucil either alone or in combination with the drug rituximab, which is the antibody against CD20 that Dr. Chesson described, are obinutuzumab and chlorambucil. And so this allowed for patients to be treated, and then you could examine how well patients did on each of these so-called arms of the clinical trial. Now, the patients who were enrolled in this trial were patients who were over age 65 and who had also medical comorbidities. And it was thought that either of these arms of therapy would be well tolerated in that age group. And it appeared that they were, but the results of the study indicate that when you couple an antibody to a drug like chlorambucil and provide what's so-called chemoimmunotherapy of a chemotherapy with an antibody therapy, that you have improved response rates. And that was borne out. Whereas a third of the patients had a good response with chlorambucil, that ratio was going up to over two-thirds with chlorambucil and the rituximab, but it's even higher with chlorambucil and obinutuzumab. And in looking at the data after therapy, it appeared that patients who had received the new anti-CD20 antibody had a longer time interval between treatment and having to require treatment again. What was very exciting about this study, too, is that a number of patients that were treated with the new antibody had a complete remission, which was without any evidence of leukemia cells in the marrow upon analysis. This is so-called absence of minimal residual disease, or MRD negative. And several patients achieved this status, and this is unheard of with the treatment of chlorambucil alone, or even treatment regimens that had chlorambucil with rituximab. So this drug was then approved for use as a frontline agent, along with chlorambucil for patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia in November of 2013 by the FDA. Another exciting development in CLL is the advent of kinase inhibitors. This takes advantage of the knowledge of the biology of the leukemia cell, and we know now how the leukemic cell is able to receive signals from the outside and integrate those into its own growth and survival. And if you use small drugs that can interfere with some of the enzymes that are important conveying those survival signals, then you can actually interfere with the survival of the leukemia cell. This has brought forward two new agents that have recently been approved for treatment of patients with CLL. One is the agent called ibrutinib. It's I-B-R-U-T-I-N-I-B, otherwise known by commercial name as Imbrivica. This was approved in March of 2014 by the FDA for treatment of patients with relapsed disease after having had prior therapy. And just in July of this year, it was approved also for patients who have adverse genetic changes, such as deletions in the chromosome 17 that are associated with a poorer response to chemotherapy. So these approvals allow for the use of this agent. Now, what's really striking about the kinase inhibitors in general, and ibrutinib in particular, is that they seem to block the ability of the leukemic cells to home to the lymph nodes in the spleen. And this can oftentimes result in a dramatic reduction in the size of the lymph nodes in the spleen within a few weeks after starting therapy. What happens, though, is that the cells end up in the bloodstream, and so patients oftentimes experience a dramatic rise in their lymphocyte or their leukemia counts. This is to be expected. This happens, and it seems to peak after about 2 months of therapy, and then in many patients, it tends to come down over time. So this is a response pattern that's observed. Patients generally are tolerating the therapy. It's an oral medication, so they take it every day. And I think one of the aspects there is that the trials that have been done, again, using randomized clinical trials, have shown some improvement in outcome of patients that received the ibrutinib versus other therapies, such as another therapy called ofatumumab, which is another monoclonal antibody that was used alone. And so that is where patients received either ibrutinib versus ofatumumab. The patients that received the drug ibrutinib appeared to have a prolonged progression-free survival, as well as a improved response rate by taking ibrutinib over taking just the antibody therapy. And as long as they continued taking the drug, they tended to do well over time. So unlike other treatment regimens, this treatment is one where patients are considered to take it for a prolonged period, and patients are not advised to stop taking the medication unless they experience an adverse reaction to the medication or develop resistance. We're concerned about the issue of resistance, and this has been seen in a few patients, and this is something that is a major problem that is being addressed now with new clinical trials. Patients may, after being on the drug for 1 or 2 years, start developing a breakthrough where they can have the drug, it's no longer as effective. And in studies also published this year in the New England Journal, some of these patients develop new mutations within the leukemic clone that makes the drug less effective than it was before. Obviously, this is only seen in a minority of cases at this time, and we're hopeful that this remains a minority, but this is something that we have to watch for with the treatment of these agents. These agents do have some toxicities. Most notably, patients may sometimes have diarrhea or arrhythmias, but these have been very low frequency. Also, there have been some patients that have had some bleeding complications, but in the registration trial that I described earlier, the incidence of bleeding was not different between patients treated with ibrutinib versus the other therapy, and so this has to be put into the context of being an unusual or infrequent complication. Another drug that was recently approved last July is idelalisib, or Zidalic. This is another kinase inhibitor that was on a study that was published this year in March in the New England Journal of Medicine. And what this study did was to compare idelalisib in combination with the drug rituximab versus a placebo and rituximab. And it was apparent that the patients who received the placebo plus rituximab had a poorer response rate, and after stopping the rituximab, they also can experience recurrent disease that required additional therapy. And again, so long as patients continued to take the idelalisib, the patients had a fairly long progression-free survival and not had to take other forms of treatment. I think the data were such that patients seemed to do better, including a survival advantage that was seen with the idelalisib arm of the trial that resulted in the premature closing of that trial, and ultimately the FDA decided to approve it in July of this year for treatment of patients with relapsed disease. I must say that these are exciting advances, but there's other therapies that are being investigated, and one is a therapy that's targeting a very important target in CLL, namely BCL2. This new drug is called 199, otherwise called ABT-199, and this is an agent which is another small molecule that you can take by mouth, and it binds to a very important protein called BCL2, which is a protein in the leukemic cell that really protects the leukemic cell from giving up the ghost by itself or in combination with either antibodies or other drugs. Now, this therapy has been very effective as the kinase inhibitors in reducing the size of lymph nodes and in reducing the leukemia cell counts at the same time. It also seems to be effective in clearing out the marrow, which is something that is difficult to see with the kinase inhibitor. Most of the kinase inhibitor studies have shown patients getting very good partial responses, but most patients do not achieve a complete remission where there's eradication of the leukemic cells in the marrow. With the 199 drug, it appears that some patients can achieve a complete remission where there's no evidence of leukemic cells in the marrow. And this is something that's quite exciting and is now the process of ongoing work to define how best to give this drug to hopefully get into complete remissions that allow for cessation of therapy and allow patients to go on with their lives without having to take continued drug therapy. This drug is very powerful, and there have to have be some caution here. In the early going, this drug was administered to patients with very, very extensive disease and very large lymph nodes. And two patients, one treated on the East Coast and one in the Northwest, on trial, experienced such massive lysis of very large lymph nodes that they actually succumbed to a condition called tumor lysis, where the tumor lyses itself so quickly that the kidneys and the heart cannot tolerate this. So this has to be administered in a very specialized center. The clinical trials that have been ongoing have actually been very conservative, admitting patients to the hospital to take a pill, and then they're watched very carefully for evidence of tumor lysis that can be treated medically, but it has to be treated very quickly because the patients do not have symptoms from this condition until they have major complications. Now, I think that the other therapies that have been developed, some that have ongoing work, and one drug that deserves mention is lenalidomide, or Revlimid. This is an agent which is called an immune modulating drug, which over time in patients who are taking the drug can actually improve immune function. And this is a peculiar feature of this drug that's not shared by other drugs, and that patients typically develop impaired immune function, but the immune system may actually undergo some improvement with these immune modulating drugs such as lenalidomide. More recent work has shown that this drug is able to halt leukemia cell progression or proliferation, and this is allowing us to try and consider how to best use this agent to be more effective in combining it with the right set of drugs that can allow for a very optimal clinical response. But certainly some patients tolerate this drug very well. Again, it has features of where it may induce a tumor flare, and some patients cannot tolerate this drug. And what's peculiar about it is that patients with chronic lymphocytic leukemia appear to be more sensitive to this drug than patients with multiple myeloma, for which the drug is most commonly used. Patients typically have to start out with 1/10 or 1/5 the dose that's commonly used in patients with myeloma and may never be able to tolerate the doses that are typically given to patients with myeloma. This is particularly important to recognize. So in being treated with lenalidomide, it's important to be treated by a center that is used to this drug and can monitor for that in the early treatment phases. Now, there are some other studies that are ongoing involving a variety of different monoclonal antibodies. We're very excited about monoclonal antibodies that target a new protein that is found only on the leukemia cells, such as ROR1, and clinical trials are beginning on this new antibody, which might be able to give a 1-2 punch against the leukemia to hopefully be able to one day eradicate the clone and hopefully achieve cures for this disease, which we've been unable to claim except in anecdotal cases so far. The other exciting development is the use of engineered T-cell therapy. This is therapy where one's own T-cells are removed, and they're engineered genetically so as they have a receptor that recognizes the leukemia cell and is able to go out and kill the leukemic cell. Now, this is a therapy that still is in its early stages, but has resulted in some very dramatic clinical remissions in a few patients. And more work needs to be done, however, to define how safely to give this new type of therapy and what type of patients might be most likely to benefit from this type of therapy. So I think I will end my discussion here, but with all the new things going on, I'd like to say that I agree very much with Dr. Chesson's advice that patients should not jump into therapy particularly when they're newly diagnosed, unless there is an indication for treatment, because patients may enjoy a long and productive life even without therapy, and we've seen this in many of our patients. So it's important to be followed to make sure that you're not developing any complications from the CLL and also not having any symptoms. But it's clear that taking these new therapies does involve also the risk of therapy. And so I would recommend that some caution be used in terms of deciding when to initiate therapy. And again, I would like to emphasize what Dr. Chesson mentioned. Getting another opinion is always important to try and map out what type of therapy, because no one therapy seems to be applicable to all patients. And it's important to take in the biology, the clinical status, other medical comorbidities that we might have as we get older, and also what types of genetic changes might be in the leukemic cells that make one therapy more suitable than another type of therapy. I think if it's done well, we can manage this disease and achieve very long and productive lives even when we have CLL. And I think it's very exciting time to see that a lot of patients are doing very well and should continue to do well. And with continued clinical research, we think we might be able to have ability to take this disease and make it something that can be treated, such as a serious infection, and hopefully get patients back to not having to worry about having CLL. So I think I'll end my discussion here, and I thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Kiss. That was wonderful and just very informative and lots of wonderful information for everybody. And I know we'll have lots of questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next presenter is Ms. Anita Welburn. Ms. Welburn is Senior Director, Patient Education and Services, Lymphoma Research Foundation, and she has really played a key role in developing today's program and in being able to access support for it as well and funding from the Lymphoma Research Foundation. So I want to have her come on now and really describe all the wonderful services that the Lymphoma Research Foundation offers. Anita?
Carolyn, for that kind introduction, and thank you to Cancer Care for our continued partnership. I'd also like to thank our esteemed faculty, Drs. Chesson and Kipps, for their time and expertise and all they do for the Lymphoma Research Foundation and people affected by CLL, SLL. I also want to acknowledge Genentech Bio-Oncology, Biogenetic, and Gilead Sciences for supporting today's call. The Lymphoma Research Foundation is the nation's largest nonprofit organization devoted exclusively to funding lymphoma research and providing people with lymphoma and healthcare professionals with up-to-date information about this type of cancer. LRF's mission is to eradicate lymphoma and serve those touched by this disease. We invest millions of dollars each year to combat lymphoma and assist those whose lives have been affected by a lymphoma diagnosis. The foundation remains dedicated to identifying a cure through an aggressively funded research program and to helping members of the lymphoma community by providing comprehensive disease-specific programs and services. To date, LRF has funded more than $55 million in lymphoma-specific research, and more than 60,000 people are served each year by our programs and services. We provide comprehensive services and programs for people dealing with a CLL, SLL diagnosis, and their caregivers. These include the Lymphoma Helpline, where our professional, specially trained staff can assist you with information, resources, and other support. Our Clinical Trials Information Service, where we help to take the questions and the myths out of what is a clinical trial, and we can assist you in your search for a clinical trial. The Lymphoma Support Network is a national one-to-one peer support program that matches lymphoma patients or caregivers with volunteers who have had similar lymphoma-related experiences. Our print and web-based publications and newsletters include our comprehensive disease booklets, our disease-specific fact sheets, and informational e-newsletters. At lymphoma.org, our website, you'll find information on a wide variety of education and support topics. From the website, you'll also find webcasts and podcasts and LRF's YouTube channel, where we have a number of video interviews with experts in the field of CLL, SLL. we encourage you to download our award-winning application, Focus on Lymphoma. It's the first mobile app for smartphones and tablets that provides patients and caregivers comprehensive content based on their lymphoma subtype, including CLL, SLL, and tools to help manage their diagnosis and treatment. The Focus on Lymphoma app allows users to record their doctor sessions, manage their medications, keep track of important blood work results, and document treatment side effects. And finally, we hope to see you at an upcoming LRF in-person patient education conference. Stay educated by attending an informative Ask the Doctor program or a lymphoma workshop. And for those in the Philadelphia area, join us on Saturday, September 20th, for a free education event with local experts, and then walk with the community on Sunday, September 21st, at our Lymphomathon. We also invite you to register and attend the National Educational Forum in Manhattan Beach, California, on Friday, October 24th through Sunday, October 26th. At this two-and-a-half-day program, you'll hear from leading experts in the field of CLL, SLL, and moderated by Dr. Bruce Chesson, who you heard today. For information on LRS programs and services and to register for an upcoming event, call the LRF helpline toll-free at 800-500-9976 or visit us on the web at lymphoma.org. If you don't have time to have your question answered today, please call the LRF helpline for assistance with any of the information you heard or for any of our programs and services. And we thank you so much for spending this time with us. Thank you. Carolyn?
Oh, thank you very much, Anita. That was a wonderful presentation and really just a wonderful resource for everyone to take advantage of the Lymphoma Research Foundation's extensive researches for people with lymphoma. I would like to say a few words about Cancer Care Services as well. Cancer Care is a nonprofit organization providing professionally trained oncology social work services to people living with cancer and with lymphoma. We provide a host of services from practical and financial assistance to counseling, a chance to talk with one of our staff about concerns that you may have. We offer online and telephone support groups. We offer workshops like the one you're on today, these type of workshops. And we also have an extensive list of publications and, of course, a website. You can call us at our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE. And visit our website at cancercare.org for additional help. So now you have a good sense of all the different services that are available to you. They're all free, both from the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care. And now we do have time for questions from our expert faculty. And I'm going to ask Kate to bring all of our expert faculty on board, everybody on board for the Q&A. And we're going to take as many of your questions as possible. And I just want to say, if we don't get to your question, please call the Lymphoma Research Foundation or Cancer Care, and our staff will address your questions. But for now, let's see if we can take as many as we can. So, Kate, would you go ahead and tell people how to queue up for questions?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And I'm showing we have a question from the line of Robert V. Your line is open.
Hello. I'd like to ask a question regarding the ABT-199, please. Am I correct in understanding that this is only administered in the clinical trials at a clinic or a hospital? And is that where the patient has to stay or just attend for the treatment? Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent question. Dr. Kipps, could you address that question?
Yes. Well, ABT-199 had a tremendous, unfortunate, but in December of 2012, with almost within 1 week of each other, we had the events that I mentioned to you, a patient treated on the East Coast and one in the Northwest, actually succumbed to this condition of tumor lysis. And so the entire program that was sponsored then by AbbVie and now AbbVie and Genentech was put on hold, and the FDA reviewed all the data. I think that the review indicated that there was striking clinical activity with the drug, and the FDA felt it was appropriate to continue with the clinical trials. But as a consequence, a number of safeguards were implemented, namely to try and stratify patients by virtue of their relative risk for developing tumor lysis. So patients with very bulky lymph nodes or high white cell counts, or the combination of the two, were put into high-risk categories, and patients with low white counts and low tumor burden were put into low-risk categories. But to be certain, I think the patients were given a very low dose of the medication, and they were hospitalized the night before to make sure that all the laboratory values were in line. And then they were monitored very closely for any of the telltale signs of tumor lysis that you can detect by chemical tests from the blood. And this has been since July of last year, allowing for patients to be treated. Very conservative approach with hospitalization of patients when they first start therapy and when they increase the dose of therapy. Fortunately, there have not been any more episodes of the tumor lysis, and hundreds of patients have now been treated. And I think it's apparent that this is a risk, but it's not a something that is going to be a problem for patients, particularly those patients who are started on the drug. There have been patients who have received this drug now for well over a year at home, and they're certainly not requiring hospitalizations or such close monitoring. It's only during the initial implementation of the trial. And I think that with the review of the safety data, there's consideration now for patients, particularly in those with the low-risk disease, to be able to treat them as an outpatient and to monitor for some of the chemical signs of tumor lysis, to use caution. But I think right now we are being overly cautious, and probably appropriately so, because this is a new type of therapy. But I do believe within the short while we'll be able to see clinical trials where patients are not having to be hospitalized, depending on their status. And also, if the drug is approved, it should then be able to be given. But again, we're going to have to pay attention that has to be given to the fact that this drug is very, very effective. But sometimes being too effective can be not a good thing.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you. And our next question, please, Stephanie.
Our next question comes from the line of Dennis V. Your line is open.
Yeah, thank you very much. I'm presently in a study at MD Anderson under Dr. Susan O'Brien with Rituxan and Ibrutinib. I'm happy to say I just finished my last infusion. My question is simply this. Dr. Kipps, you gave a lot of really great information, but I could not write fast enough. Will this be somewhere available for us to go back and see the transcripts?
So I'll actually answer that, Dennis. Just these calls are recorded, and they are available as podcasts as well as telephone replay, so that you'll be able to access the call, this particular today's workshop, within about, I would say, 2 hours after the call ends, and you'll be able to hear the call again, both as a podcast, or else you can listen to it on telephone replay as well. And I hope that helps. Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants, and the question is there a relationship, any relationship between CLL, SLL, and low iron stores and low ferritin levels, or are my iron issues unrelated? I have been tested to be sure no GI bleeding or celiac disease. Dr. Chesson, could you address this in a general way? And then, of course, we encourage our participant to return to their healthcare provider for further clarification. Dr. Chesson?
It does appear that his line is disconnected.
Dr. Kipps, could you address
that? I think it's important. Iron is a very important mineral, of course, and iron deficiency in the United States is the leading cause for anemia. But it's a leading cause for anemia because it is reduced the iron stores when one has bleeding, and women, because of the obligate blood loss when they are of childbearing age, will oftentimes lose blood and become iron deficient. Now, if the iron stores are low, it has probably taken a while for them to become low. It's important to evaluate for any source of blood loss, which is the most common cause for iron deficiency. Sometimes it can be nutrition, but it's most likely due to some form of loss. And it's very important because that could point to another medical condition if it's not through menstrual blood loss. The iron deficiency itself does not seem to affect the clinical course or the incidence of CLL. And in my opinion, they are two different things. It's important, however, to recognize that when patients with CLL develop anemia, the patient may have iron deficiency that causes the anemia and not the CLL. And this is very important because anemia is a very common complication in CLL. And anemia or low platelet counts is one of the indications to go forward with treatment against the CLL. So if you have anemia and CLL, it's very important to get evaluated for other causes of anemia, including nutritional causes or causes due to blood loss, so that you can actually correct that cause and correct the anemia, and that might obviate the treatment for the CLL. It would be a mistake to engage in therapy either with the conventional treatments or the newer treatments and to miss another major medical problem that could become worse in the context of treatment for the CLL.
Thank you very much. Excellent. I have a question now for Dr. Chesson. It was mentioned that many patients may not need treatment at time of diagnosis. And approximately what the percentage or how often does this happen? And I wonder if you could just say a bit more about this, Dr. Chesson.
Sure. In many studies, it's about half the patients who are initially diagnosed with CLL that don't need initial treatment because they may have had the disease for months or for even years without even knowing it. We frequently see patients who have the diagnosis made, and in fact, when we get older records, they may have had it years ago. So it's usually at least half the patients don't need initial therapy.
Thank you. And another question is, while elevated lymphocytes are expected in CLL, if a patient is asymptomatic and has no lymph node involvement, what lymphocyte elevation level would be of concern clinically? Dr. Chesson, again, could you address this question in a general way? Thank you.
In general, there is no lymphocyte count that is hazardous to your health in CLL, whereas in acute leukemia, there certainly is. We've seen patients who walk around with lymphocyte counts of over 100 or 200,000. Usually, when they get up that high, it's associated with something else. But the lymphocyte count in and of itself does not precipitate the need for treatment. The rapidity with which the lymphocyte count increases has been used by some as an index to at least consider therapy. The lymphocyte count doubling in 6 months or 12 months, depending if you're French or Spanish, has been used. So if your white count goes from 20,000 to 40,000 in 6 months or 12 months, then it may be time to start having a discussion about treatment. But even the doubling is a relative thing. We have patients whose white counts go from 10 to 20, and that's not the same as someone whose white count goes from 50 to 100. Because that's a much greater tumor burden. So the absolute lymphocyte count in and of itself generally is not an index to start treatment.
Excellent. Actually, a question for Anita. Where do you go to get the focus on lymphoma application?
Absolutely. Thank you, Carolyn. You can find that information on the LRF website, and that is lymphoma.org. And the application is very simple to download on any smart device. And if you have any difficulty with that, you can always contact the LRF helpline, and we can walk you through that process.
Excellent. Thank you very much. That's very important. Now, I have another question. I have CLL, SLL. I have a severe chronic cough treated successfully with Advair. The cough does not seem to be a significant symptom in the literature. Why is this? Again, Dr. Chesson, would you want to address that?
Well, cough is not generally a finding of CLL in the absence of other features such as infection. And CLL puts patients at an increased risk of infections, whether it be pneumonias and sinus infections, which are the two most common ones that I see. So it cough in and of itself in the absence of infection is not commonly associated with CLL or SLL, and one would consider either an infective cough, an infectious cough, or some other medical condition as the cause of the cough and not CLL just of itself.
We have another question from one of our online participants, for Dr. Kipps. If you have had successful therapy with FCR or BR and relapse after a few years, what is the decision calculus for choosing the original therapy again or one of the new approved therapies? And again, I'll ask Dr. Kipps to address this in a general way, and then, of course, we would advise you to go back to your treating healthcare team.
I think, in generally, what most CLL experts would agree upon is that if you've gone through chemoimmunotherapy of either FCR or BR or some other chemoimmunotherapy regimen, and you get into a response either partial or complete, but the duration of that response is short, namely less than 2 years, most would agree that it's probably not advised to go forward with the same regimen again. And that is because these regimens do have some toxicity on the marrow-making cells, and if you have repeated administration of these drugs, you can have toxicity, and also there is a chance of developing resistance to these agents. And it's clear that even with the first therapy, it's usually your outcome is typically better than with subsequent therapy, and if the outcome only resulted in a progression-free survival of less than 2 years, that's not really asking that you're going to achieve very much with additional treatment of the same regimen. We typically recommend that patients undergo repeat FISH analysis before repeat therapy, because oftentimes there can be you can acquire a chromosomal deletion in chromosome 17. That's typically associated with resistance to chemotherapy, and in those particular patients, we certainly would not recommend retreatment with chemotherapy. I think it's the duration of the response, the quality of the response, and the tolerance of the regimen. All of those have to be factored in as to whether repeat with chemoimmunotherapy should be given. I must say that some patients after chemoimmunotherapy may have a very long interval between when they're treated and when they require treatment again. And this is something that has been seen in follow-up data. And it's interesting that some patients may go nearly a decade without having to require new therapy after successful treatment with FCR. And those patients, it might become debatable whether retreatment is a option, provided they don't have any new genetic changes that would argue that they would become less sensitive to those drugs that were used in the first treatment.
Excellent. This is an important question that comes up on many of our calls. My husband has SLL. Is there anything I can do to reduce the risk for SLL for our children? So, and Dr. Chesson and Dr. Kipps, would you both want to address this question? It's probably one of your.
Sure. What I tell patients in my initial discussion with them when they come with the diagnosis of CLL or SLL is that it is familial, but it is not hereditary, which means that there is an increased risk in families, but there is no direct transmission from parent to child to parent to child. It can be sporadic. It can be your grandmother had it and your uncle Frank had it, and now you've got it. So there is no clear pathway of transmission. So therefore, there's really nothing you can do to screen the rest of the family members. The risk is increased to have CLL in family members, but it's not high enough. It's only a couple of percent that to put them through any sort of extensive evaluation.
I think that I agree with Dr. Chesson. You know, we're now analyzing over 6,000 patients, and it seems that about 8% of the patients will have a family member that has also CLL, which is to say 92% of the time a patient does not have any family member or any history of CLL. So I would say if it's uncommon for families to have CLL, but it does run in families, and if there is a familial CLL, then I think just getting routine medical checkups as you would ordinarily do for good health management to monitor the blood count. But I must say it would be a mistake to try and aggressively try to evaluate whether there's a pre-CLL lesion in folks, even from familial CLL, unless you had something to do for those patients. It would be a mistake to label them as having a problem when they may not have any problem that can be recognized other than maybe a special test. So I think what we do need is to go forward with further research in this area to improve therapy so that we can define curative treatment for patients with CLL. And then that way we can put the disease in the rearview mirror with everyone that has this disease, or potentially family members who might develop the disease later on.
Well, I want to thank you. I want to actually thank our speakers today. They've really been exceptional, really wonderful. And I want to thank all of you also who've been listening on the call today and who've asked such great questions either on the telephone or online. I do want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour education workshop, and we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And therefore, this is a partnership program today with the Lymphoma Research Foundation and Cancer Care, so that when the program ends, it doesn't mean that your access to services ends, and that if you have a question that you didn't get to ask, that you have a place to go to ask those questions. And we very much encourage you to contact the Lymphoma Research Foundation for any of your medically focused questions. And their helpline is 1-800-500-9976. And for any of your requests for counseling, you can contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. Most importantly, as we are about to conclude the program today, I would not want anyone to think that they're alone in coping with CLL, SLL, or in coping with lymphoma or cancer in general. I want you to know that you are now part of this community of support that we offer, and that we really want you to take advantage of these services. Many of you may do this already, but for those of you who aren't or who may have not called recently, don't hesitate to call. We are simply a telephone call away, or you also can access our websites for help as well. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may disconnect. Have a wonderful day.